Accession number 28678, Mr. Dermot Rhodes, Reel 6. Now, we just got to where you joined HMS Springer at Portland, probably May 57. And you were saying that you learned very quickly. Now, tell me about that. What were you learning? What did you have to learn?
Well, the main thing was to learn how a submarine worked mechanically, and B, how it worked personnel-wise. Personnel-wise, the best way to learn was actually mix with them and talk with them. Mechanically, it was a bit more difficult. You had to go around and really be told by the experts there what went on. And that's what I did most of the time. I did a lot more navigation. I learnt that, again, very quickly, within the first couple of days, that submarines, particularly diesel submarines, have a very distinctive smell of a sort of mixture of torpedo oil and diesel oil, which very quickly impregnates your clothes. So,
did you find it unpleasant or...?
No, you get used to it. Very quickly, you don't notice it. It's other people who come into the submarine too. Or if you go ashore wearing your old suit. And in those days, we still wore white shirt and collar, a reefer jacket. But the submariners had a tradition of wearing the most disreputable, tatty old things with the stripes hanging off and the buttons missing. Or you could wear a submarine sweater, which was a white sweater, polo neck, woolly sweater, but didn't often wear that actually inside the submarine because it was quite warm. The great thing about submarines is that you can be a raging gale on the surface and you're heaving up and down all over the place. Once you dive and get below about 30 or 40 feet, it's quiet, lovely and quiet and peaceful.
Now, what was life, what were your duties on a typical day?
Well, my duties were mixed, and it mainly revolved around assisting people, and particularly the watchkeepers, bridge watchkeeping if we were surfaced, and control room watchkeeping if we were submerged. Being a diesel submarine, you were limited a bit in these days of nuclear boats as to the amount of time you could spend submerged. Because, of course, you were then running on the batteries, which needed charging from time to time. So I understudied them. I understudied the coxswain who was steering the boat, and I understudied the engineer officer, torpedo navigator. All this was all the time, as well as assimilating the sort of pace and the type of life on board. I didn't have a bunk of my own. I had to hot bunk, as they call it.
How crowded was it? And,
very crowded. bunks were slotted in all over the submarine. The officers slept more or less around the wardroom. The captain had his own little sort of cubbyhole, which was part of the wardroom. Then one or two other senior officers, first lieutenant and the engineer, had their own bunks in the wardroom. And then the more junior ones slept possibly outside against the side of the submarine in racks and bunks. I had no bunk, there was no bunk for me. So I used to do what they call hot bunking. I used to be on watch, and after I come down off watch, I go into the bunk of the guy who just left to come on watch. In the very few occasions in which we had to sleep on board in harbour, I slept on a lilo on the chart table. But one major visit during that 6 months, we went to Wilhelmshaven in Germany, and it was the first visit of a British submarine to this major naval base since the war in Germany. But we had a great reception, nice people.
What do you remember of the visit?
Very kind. I remember just how very kind and how very sort of talkative and friendly the Germans were. We had the ship open to visitors, and we were queues all the time wishing to come and see and merely talk to us. It seemed almost every other taxi driver had been a U-boat captain during the war. but it was lovely. It was fair. It was pretty well battered, mind you, mainly by our bombers during the war. So that was that. And that was after 6 months, the end of my... We did some other cruises up.
And what did you think of submarine role? Did you enjoy it, or was it not...
No, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, as a youngster, you put up with all sorts of privations and dreadful conditions. The food was pretty basic as well. That's where I learned. I mean, knew it.
What was the food?
Well, we had one cook, and he cooked for everybody. And the officers ate. I mean, we all ate the same sort of thing, but it was basic submarine fare, like babies' heads. Now, babies' heads were suet dumplings swimming in a sort of stew. And I cannot abide suet, so I didn't have too many babies' heads. And various other submarine dishes. Hits, herrings in tomato sauce. There were tins and tins and tins of those. There was one shower. Was there a shower? Yes, there was one shower. One toilet for the officers, and shared by the crew. There were about three toilets scattered about. And you had to do a special course to learn how to operate the toilet. Otherwise, very embarrassing blowbacks could occur, which made you extremely unpopular.
The shower, just one shower. Mm. Was cleanliness very important? I'm thinking of this hot bunking business, because, I mean, if anything untoward did happen, it would spread, I presume.
Yes. I think one has to remember that these diesel submarines, you did not go to sea for weeks on end like the big nuclear boats do now. You went to sea for very fairly short periods of time, normally quite concentrated in terms of activity. Whenever you came into harbour, you tried to live ashore. That would even go on foreign visits or visits outside your base to staying in a local hotel. And that was quite common for submariners. So it was very unusual to have to live on the boat while you were in harbour. And certainly, if you were back at naval bases, you moved out lock and stock and barrel out of the submarine to a shore mess or a shore wardroom. And you had, of course, fairly rigorous and full medical inspections. You had a medical, used to be then known as a sick berth attendant, actually, on board. So you were fairly closely watched. I mean, you were all fit blokes anyway, basically. So I can't remember in my 6 months there being any problem.
And you had no claustrophobia or any?
I was lucky. No, I had no claustrophobia at all.
So, anything happened in the 6 months? Visit to Wilhelmshaven, anything else?
No, we did a few exercises and one or two.
What were the exercises
particularly
like?
Portland. Well, they could be quite dull if you didn't know exactly what was going on at the time, and not many people did, except possibly, well, hopefully for the captain and one or two others. But of course, you couldn't see anything, and probably you couldn't hear anything. And we used to do a lot of exercises called KSEXs, which were exercises with escorts. And from time to time, it was always a question of them trying to find the submarine. Sometimes the more advanced ones, you trying to penetrate a destroyer screen to get at the big ships in the middle. But from time to time, if they couldn't find you, or for specific reasons, the submarine had to indicate its position, and it would fire a smoke candle. And depending on the colour of the smoke candle, you could tell what the submarine was doing or thinking. A white one were the most common ones, and that just meant it was indicating its position. And that was it. No more excitement. On the very rare occasions you fired a torpedo, that was a major incident. But the main aim in firing a torpedo was to get it back again, having fired it. And they used to have buoyant heads in these practice torpedoes, which meant that after it had run its course, and you set it deep to go underneath the target ship and then surface at the other side, and it then bobbed up and down with its nose out of the water, and you went and, or somebody, a special torpedo recovery vessel, went and picked it up. If for some reason you lost this torpedo, which was a few thousand quid's worth of taxpayers' money, there was quite a rigorous investigation and search as to why it hadn't surfaced and blown and where it might be. So that was torpedo firing. Otherwise, our exercises were a bit boring, really, compared with, say, a surface ship with anti-aircraft and a whole heap of variable exercises to do.
Was there a specific character you could discern about the nature of submarine crews? I mean, did they have any characteristics?
Oh, particularly. Oh, my goodness. Submariners reckon they were the bee's knees. And anybody else was really not worth talking to. They had one great advantage. They were paid a lot more than the average chap. They were paid, submarine pay was something which they got all the time when they were serving in submarines. And it was, I don't know what it was, then, a pound a day or something, but it was quite significant in those days, a pound a day extra. The only other people who got permanent extra pay were fleet air arm and some divers. But the submariners thought they were the creme de la creme, and they made no bones about proclaiming this whenever they met any what they called disparagingly general service people ashore or anywhere else.
Now, were
so there was a great esprit de corps in the submarine.
I understand there was that they had a good morale, but were they actually an elite force, or were they just they chose to see themselves?
No, they were in many ways an elite force. They were all volunteers, right from the top to the bottom, and certainly when I left submarines, I later stage of my career when I was asked to volunteer. There were more volunteers than there were places to go into submarines.
Now, anything else before we move on? You were on there for 6 months. That would be, roughly speaking, what, to November?
I think roughly about that, yeah.
And what happened? You just came to the end of your 6 months?
Yes. Nothing other specific, amusing bits and pieces. Again, submarines are always very popular on Navy days. We took part in Navy days and open to visitors. And there were always queues to get down submarines from the public. And we had one or two interesting experiences.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I remember specifically one quite sort of large lady who got down one end of the submarine but couldn't get out the other end. And another lady who got down and had an attack of the jitters halfway through and sat down and said, I'm not going any further. And she wouldn't go forward and wouldn't go back. Put a cup of tea and a sit down sorted her out eventually. And really it was again, not the first time, but it was, I think, a restatement of the fact that how much we, the ship's companies and the sailors, enjoyed meeting the public, and it was the only time these people would ever see what we did and where we were. Navy days took an enormous amount of time and energy to organise and take part in. All our leave was stopped, but we reckoned it was worthwhile for the public to see what their taxpayers' money was being spent on.
Now, what happened when you left then?
I left the Springer. In about August, September of that year.
September.
August. Was it August, September? Must have been nearer Christmas, because then I went to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. This, again, was the next phase of my training, and the Royal Naval College at Greenwich was like the Navy's university in London. And we also did, at that time, and this was a two-term, was it two terms or three terms? I think it was 9 months. 9 months. We also did a junior officer's war course. So we did an amalgam of educational subjects, classic subjects, anything of interest. Greenwich then was staffed by a very erudite and interesting team of civilian historians, mathematicians, linguists, and also naval experts in many fields, and also representatives from the Army and the RAF to do the war course aspects.
Now, what do you remember of the training you got there in more detail? if you do.
My memories of Greenwich were playing a lot of sport, particularly hockey. I played for the college at hockey. Seeing a lot of the pubs around Greenwich, getting to know the pubs around the south east of England, getting to know all the nurses' homes in Chelsea, the Guy's Hospital, the Middlesex Hospital, the London colleges. The social life was amazing there. We were on Greenwich then, which was, there must have been about 200, 20, 21-year-old acting subalterns. And we also had representatives of the Commonwealth there, Canadians, Indians, Pakistanis, Australians.
Would every subalternant?
And the world were our oyster, yes. Every general is subalternant in the Navy.
And how seriously did you take your studies amidst this?
It varied. It varied actually quite a lot amongst amongst the cadets. Some took them quite seriously. Some didn't take them at all seriously, and some sort of just jogged along.
And where were you?
Well, I reckon it was. I mean, I'd never lived or worked or even seen London before, and to my mind, it was absolute paradise. But I also reckon this was my chance to do something I really wanted to do. You were allowed to do studies two specialist subjects. They had to be approved by the college education authorities. But, I mean, the remit was fairly broad, and it was your sort of thoughts. Yes, yeah, so two specialist subjects. Now, I was always very interested in languages and linguists, and I'd started studying Spanish, having done French and Latin at my grammar school, started studying Spanish at the Naval College at Dartmouth, and I wanted to continue with this, so I opted to study Spanish with the aim of taking my preliminary interpreter's exam at Greenwich, which I did, actually. I also wanted to keep on with my music. I sang in the college choir at Greenwich, and I took as my other optional subject musical appreciation, that's classical music.
Well, which what happens did that have to the Navy? Or did they not mind that it was just personal development?
No, it's personal development. This was what their aim. It was specifically you were encouraged to choose a subject which had no connection with the Navy at all as a mind broadener to make you more interested, to give you something to talk about, these endless cocktail parties you were going to attend, and make you more interesting. And their idea was that you should enjoy Greenwich. I mean, that was the only opportunity you were going to get in the Navy, to live any form of life which approximated to the normal sort of university student. So that was it, and it was great. Wonderful time.
Now, were there exams at the end of it? I mean, were there?
No, there were certain things that were... There were no exams as such. There were certain aspects of the subjects. I had to write a thesis on... one of the subjects I had to study was history. And I had to write a thesis. The subject of the thesis was your own choice, as approved by your tutor. And so I wrote mine. And I still got it to this day. And I got an alpha for it.
What did you choose?
I said... The influence of the longbow on medieval warfare... Which was interesting to do, because, again, that's something I'd never done before, writing a composition like that, using the sort of research facilities that were available there, which was terrific.
So yeah. After you're 9 months there, so that would take...
So 9 months there, and sadly we were dragged out of there, kicking and struggling, back down to earth.
So when did you finish?
To 1958, to... we then went on subalternate courses, specialist courses. Now,
Now, do you know when you left? Would it be, what, August or?
Well, this this was...
roughly.
This must have been... 58, 59. No, middle of 58, I think, probably.
Okay. Now, so what were these courses?
A year. Well, these courses consisted of visits to all the Navy specialist schools. By visits, I mean actually courses there. Their courses varied from 2 weeks to 4 weeks long. And you actually lived in the specialist school, and so therefore we went to HMS Vernon for a torpedo anti-submarine course, HMS Excellent for a gunnery course. We did the fleet air-arm course at the Royal Naval Air Station at Ford, which is now a prison. we did a divisional course of 2 weeks at the Royal Naval Barracks in Portsmouth. We did a signals course at HMS Mercury in Portsmouth. We did engineering at HMS Collingwood and Sultan. We did... I'm running out. We did another submarine course at HMS Dolphin.
Now, was this the idea that you then choose a specialisation, or was this...
That's the idea... But there was also an idea, because at the end of each of these courses you had an examination, a written examination, all of which, or the combined results of which, went towards your passing out, overall passing out exams. And you were rewarded seniority on the type of class you got passing out. And so each course... You either got a first, second, or third class pass. And then these were aggregated at the end for an overall level of pass. So they were quite important. But they also gave you a very good insight into specializations which you may either have not contemplated joining or wouldn't be joining. I mean, for instance, I, as an executive officer, did courses at the Supply Secretariat School, also the engineering schools, which was not my specialisation anyway, but it gave me a good insight into what they did and what went on there.
So it's all part of making you a well-rounded officer as well?
Absolutely.
Now this is, what, 58 to 6, 58 to 59?
This is 58 to 59, yeah. Early 59, well, yes, 59.
What then?
You take these courses, and then you got a pass. Again, I got a second class pass. And then the idea was to go to sea, really for the last phase of our general phase training, which was to get your bridge ocean watchkeeping certificate. Bridge watchkeeping certificate. And I was appointed then to the most extraordinary ship called HMS Girdle Ness. G-I-R-D-L-E, new word, N-E-S-S. Now, HMS Girdle Ness was an old, a wartime Liberty ship, a merchant ship, single screw, steam reciprocating, maximum speed 11 knots, and it had been converted for missile firing trials at sea. And this was the Sea Slug missile, which is really the first medium-range missile in the Navy, a sea-to-air, surface-to-air missile the Navy ever had.
Now, what did you know much about the Sea Slug?
No, I knew nothing at all. Well, I mean, it had been mentioned during my gunnery course at HMS Excellent during my subaltern's time. So, I mean, I knew what it was. I knew it existed, and I knew it was still in trials phase. But otherwise, nothing at all.
Now, what happened? You went aboard her in early 59.
I went, yes, I went to her early 59, where I was, as the junior boy, I was the laundry and sports officer. And I shall never forget going to do a laundry course in the barracks laundry at Devonport.
Now, what... What did you do as laundry inspector? What were the two separate functions, I presume?
Yeah.
So what was the laundry officer do?
Well, the laundry officer took charge of the laundry and make sure it was run efficiently and for the benefit of the ship's company. And I had a leading stoker and four, I think, mixture of a stoker, a seaman, and a writer, and a stores assistant, as my laundry crew, who actually did the laundering. But of course, they were all co-opted, and they and me, like me, did a quick course. The equipment was reasonably fairly basic, and so our results, to start with, were not exactly very brilliant, but we worked up. The biggest problem, of course, was losing items of gear. We got that down to a minimum, but I was continually seemed to be juggling from one week to the next to make sure people got back what they thought they'd sent in.
Now, more to your taste, I suspect, role of sports officer.
Yeah, the sports... well, I had a qualified PTI on board who was also a first-class soccer referee, which is jolly useful. But he really did the nitty-gritty of organising of the ship's sports and sports programme under my aegis. And he and I used to talk about sort of forecast programmes, where the ship was going, what could do, this, that and the other. And he would organise the teams and so on and so forth. And I'd lay down the groundwork of approaching various senior officers to release sportsmen for various tasks.
Did you enjoy the role?
Yes, funnily enough, I enjoyed both roles. My main job on board, though, was to get a bridge watchkeeping ticket. So I spent a fair old time on the bridge.
Now, how do you qualify for a bridge watchkeeping certificate?
Well, it's very simple, really. You show that you're competent to take charge and navigate safely the bridge under all conditions of seagoing activity. That's on passage and during exercises. And it's purely a subjective view of the captain. And so you start off mainly as a second officer watch, in other words, with a qualified guy. At some stage, maybe after, depending on how much sea time you've done, a month or even 2 months, the captain may say, right, I'm happy for you to do a watch on your own during the day. And then later on, when you get more experience, you go solo at night. And then, and I think it's a year, it took a year, the captain would then either award you a bridge watchkeeping certificate, a full bridge watchkeeping certificate, or not, as the case may be, in which case, if not, then you'd have to do a further period of probationary time. But that full bridge watchkeeping ticket authorised you to become a bridge watchkeeper in any ship in the Navy, apart from submarines. So it could be anything, battleship, aircraft carrier, right down to minesweeper. Here was I, in an old merchant ship that couldn't do more than 11 knots, with destroyers dashing around me at 30 knots on twin screws, steam reciprocating. And so it was a fairly large jump. But the basics were there, the fact that ship safety, navigation and all that were actually learnt on the job there. And we did that. Now, my captain at the time was, he became Second Sea Lord Admiral Sir Andrew Lewis.
He was the captain, so Captain Andrew Lewis?
He was Captain Andrew Lewis later.
What was he like?
He was a miserable bugger.
In what way?
He was a gunnery officer, and so therefore people were in awe of him anyway. We all were, as well as captain. He very rarely smiled. He was quite austere. He didn't seem to relax. The most he would unbend, if an officer had done something outstandingly competent and good and efficient, then he would call him old so-and-so for about a day or maybe 2 days. The commander, second in command, would call me by my Christian name. I would never dare call anybody senior to me by the Christian, but to juniors it would be done quite normal. But the cat, this old Andrew Lewis never did. Now, I crossed him twice